Hello, it's Tuesday, July the 6th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, those fabulous photographs of the Queen in today's Daily Mail. What is the poignant promise to Prince Philip which lies behind those radiant smiles? And did you know this? Because I certainly didn't. You can get sunburn on your eyes, even in Britain, even in this lousy summer where the sun is hardly shining. Hope growing now for summer holidays abroad? Germany now says we can go there. And finally, a new poll suggests that most people will carry on wearing masks, and they support the decision of the Prime Minister to allow people to make their minds up. So Boris Johnson finally announced that people could take their own decisions on whether to wear masks to protect against COVID from 19th of July, widely now known as Freedom Day. But a new survey shows that people don't trust others to take safety measures, and even more interestingly, don't even trust themselves. The survey by Savannah Comrades found that 54% say the public can't be trusted to take measures to protect themselves from coronavirus. 38% say they don't trust themselves either. Chris Hopkins is the Associate Director at Savannah Comrades. It's the great debate, isn't it, Chris, at the moment? The Prime Minister, the government, the Cabinet, call it what you will, decided to let people make their own choice about masks. And it's a question that is dividing the nation.
Yeah, it's really strange, really, if you think about all of the great debates that we've had over the last 18 months, that it comes down to a little bit of cloth covering one's face. But yeah, it seems to be the real dividing issue at the minute, and as you say, you know, the government have tried to shift responsibility away from the state and to individuals, and it doesn't seem as though the public really thinks that they can trust themselves. Obviously, you know, I'm sure anyone answering our polls will be able to trust themselves, but they don't think that the wider populace can really be trusted, and therefore that the government should continue to make the rules for us. And I think that that's interesting, really. It sort of speaks to a lot of what we've seen in the data throughout the pandemic, in the sense that, you know, the government have not really been blamed when things have gone massively wrong, and the public have blamed, you know, the public at large. People have sort of blamed themselves. So yeah, that's allowed the government to kind of get away with things, and for, you know, us, I guess, as the British public, to pin the blame on our neighbours and others. This kind of tells me that even if cases do go up and hospitalisations do increase, that the public aren't going to blame the government, they're going to continue to blame other people.
That's very interesting. And I noticed that three quarters say they'll continue social distancing while queuing. It may be in a shop or a train station or something, railway station. And a similar proportion, they'll continue wearing face coverings on public transport if it's busy, and in shops when they're busy. And I think also, Chris, I know from my own point of view, I'm going to always have a mask with me. And if I go in a shop and I sense that people are uncomfortable, I've not got a mask, and I'm going to put it on. And I think perhaps that will be the response of a lot of people.
Yeah, I think so. And obviously the data, the percentages here saying that they're going to do that are quite high. And you know, ultimately that does sort of present these findings with a bit of a dichotomy. And lots of people saying that they will carry on doing these things, yet they don't trust that others will. Yet, you know, so many are saying that they will carry on doing them. Therefore, you would assume that lots and lots of people will, and there is no reason really for the average member of the public to worry about the public at large. So it is a bit of an interesting one. I think that, you know, another interesting finding here is that, and we did kind of set up some different scenarios for people about whether they would or wouldn't wear masks. And using the public transport example, you know, 74% said they would wear one if the public transport, you know, that they were traveling on was busy, and then just 64%, so only 10 percentage points fewer, say that they would wear one if it was quiet. So we should, in theory, if this, you know, data is to be, you know, it sort of translates into general attitudes when the time comes, we should still see a fairly high level of face covering compliance.
Yes.
But obviously whether that actually happens kind of does remain to be seen.
I think it will, because I mean, you just speak from experience and anecdotally with your friends and colleagues. But I mean, wearing a mask, taking a mask out is now part of my routine, in the same way taking my iPad or a pen or a pass to get me on the tube. So I think we've got used to it. And of course, if you go to...
I think that's completely true, Andrew. And I think what also this does sort of confirm, and you know, I don't want to get on any sort of, you know, section of society's back particularly, but I think that there is a loud but small proportion of society that do feel that wearing face coverings and you know, all of the restrictions that are still left are having some sort of big impact on their freedoms, and the public at large don't really feel like that. You know, I don't think that the public see wearing a face covering as a massive limitation, a massive restriction on their civil liberties. Therefore, you know, if it keeps other people safe and keeps them safe, then they're going to continue to do it. I think that, you know, the doubt that comes from the public here, as I say, is from whether they think you know, the rest of the population are going to see things the way they do. But yeah, you know, if the behavioural side of this data is to be believed, then there shouldn't really be too much of a problem.
And for Boris Johnson, there's nothing in these figures that will trouble him about the public's response to what he's announced in the last 24 hours.
Not at all. I mean, yeah, I think I'd describe this as kind of music to the Prime Minister's ears, really. Much of the emphasis behind this Freedom Day, as it's being dubbed, is a move towards an approach that relies less on government rules and more on individual responsibility. And in that sense, you know, people are going to continue to do that according to this data. So yeah, you know, that's definitely going to be good news for him. And then secondly, if everything does go wrong, there's nothing to suggest here that the public are going to start blaming the government all of a sudden. So yeah, it really is a bit of a win-win for the Prime Minister and the government.
Fascinating. That's Chris Hopkins, who's Associate Director at Savanta Comres. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series, of course. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Hope seems to be dawning for summer holidays as Germany is lifting a COVID-related travel ban on people from the UK. Government ministers said they will change the rule so that those who are now fully vaccinated can avoid self-isolation on returning from amber list countries. But travel industry figures are calling for greater clarity. I'm joined now by the aviation analyst, Alex Macheras. Alex, if I could just mention Germany first. It's interesting because Angela Merkel was the figure most of all in the European Union that was pushing for British holidaymakers to be excluded from European Union countries because of the outbreak of the Indian/Delta variant. And yet here it is now. Germany seems to be one of the first to say British tourists can go there.
Exactly. It's endless U-turns. And I think this will not be the only example of this as the summer continues, not least because we have so many different ways in which countries are trying to determine or decide how to ultimately categorize places like the UK. And I would say we have turbulence ahead with the fact that we have our own health secretary here now admitting that there could be some days where the UK is declaring 100,000 new cases per day, but they're saying that's fine because they won't turn into a sharp rise of hospitalizations. We'll tell that to the countries who are still classifying and categorizing countries on their own lists purely based on the case rate and the case numbers. And that's why I think, you know, Germany, yep, okay, so they've U-turned now, which is good news for those who need to get there. And there are so many that need to get there, not least for friends and family. But I think that won't be the end of it. I think we'll be seeing more U-turns as the summer continues.
Now, what of other amber list countries? So I'm thinking about countries that a lot of our Daily Mail readers, Mail Plus readers, listeners want to go to. I'm thinking France, Italy, Greece. What is the current position about going to those countries? If we go there, do we still have to isolate for 10 days when we get back?
There are two things that listeners and readers need to always keep in mind. Number one, what are the rules of the countries that you're then traveling to? That must come first. And then, of course, it's what you face when you return to the UK. So, for example, to go to France now, if you are fully vaccinated, France is welcoming the world's travellers who are fully vaccinated, and that includes Brits. Spain, they are on the same page as this. But also, if you are not vaccinated and you can take a PCR test and test negative, well, then Spain will also take you. With France, not just yet. They would prefer you to be vaccinated, but you can, for example, go to Greece. But as with everything, it does determine, you know, ultimately what you face then when you return back to the UK. So you've got those two considerations. And right now, those countries that predominantly UK tourists would travel to over the summer period, they are still on the amber list. But as you mentioned in the introduction of this segment, The Amber List will become accessible to more people over the coming weeks because, finally, they will be exempting those who are fully vaccinated from quarantine if you are returning from Amber List countries.
And when does that take effect, Alex? Or is it already in effect?
It's not in effect yet. We're speaking now in early July, but we expect it to take place either on that so-called Freedom Day, which is on the 19th of July, or very shortly after this, but there has been no concrete confirmation of this. I suspect we will know by the end of this week after the Transport Secretary has given his own press conference to outline how it will work. Because, of course, it's not going to be as simple as giving a date. They need to explain how it will work for fully vaccinated parents who have children who are not vaccinated, for example, or unaccompanied minors, or children who are travelling between two separated parents, and so on. So there are so many considerations they have to iron out before they implement this policy. And crucially, what we know for sure now is that this will not be a policy like France and like Spain have done, where the UK will not be opening to the world's fully vaccinated travellers. Actually, it will still remain UK residents.
Right, gosh, it's a head. It's, so where is the travel industry in all of this, Alex? They've had a shocker of a 15-16 months, and they must be nervous that even if our people are now going to start booking to go to Amber List countries such as France or Spain, if we then do get 100,000 infections in a day, and the health secretary was very clear about it, he'd said it without any apology, then that could then lead to France or withdrawing the quarantine rules again, all over again, or just in fact banning us altogether.
Exactly. There is a very real chance of this. I think this is what we're going to see over the summer, which again fills the aviation and travel sector with dread. You know, this is a sector that has been devastated by the pandemic more than most industries. And I know everyone has suffered, but more than most. And ultimately, it's that lack of consistency and clarity. Yes, it's positive news on one side that those who are fully vaccinated coming from a place like France, Spain, Greece, that are currently on the UK's Amber List, they will be able to return without quarantine. That's a positive. But then what happens when the European Union countries begin to point to the UK and say, hold on a minute, they're declaring almost 100,000 cases a day, perhaps of this, the so-called India Delta variant. Well, then we know what typically follows then, sanctions and an action against UK travel. And we've seen this throughout. And that's why I would say it's all very well for the Health Secretary to admit that, you know, without apology, that's going to be the scenario and Brits should begin to get their heads around that. I would say they need to be having conversations with their EU counterparts and with counterparts from all across the world to get them on the same page and to see if there is that understanding. Because if there is not, once again, the UK will be considered what was dubbed in the winter as Plague Island, whereby the case numbers in the UK were rocketing compared to everywhere else. And therefore, we saw these travel restrictions that were hitting those who are just trying to have some kind of normality with flying, with jobs, with the travel sector, with being able to work amid what is this new normal.
Just finally, Alex, what is your advice to people listening to this podcast? So, for instance, I want to go to France for a few days at the end of July. Is your advice currently not to book anything just yet?
I would say that bookings are fine to be made, and I've consistently said that it is okay to book, but you should be trying to book on the most flexible terms possible, because the U-turns by governments, not just here in the UK, but of those governments that you are travelling to, the regional restrictions, they are without notice, they are without apology, and they come in and simply cite COVID. And so as a result, in order to just protect yourself and cushion any blow, ultimately, try to book on the most flexible terms possible, not just the flights and ensuring that your airlines have flexible terms, but also anything like your accommodation, if you're taking car rental and so on, just so that you have peace of mind that you won't be chasing these companies for the next 9 months over a sudden rule change, thanks to either the government here or abroad.
Very interesting advice. That's the aviation analyst, Alex Macharis. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe? Where you can get access to our podcasts, our videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, you tweet us at MailPlus or me at ToryBoyPierce. After her lonely grief at Prince Philip's funeral, the Queen has been raising Britain's spirits with some extraordinarily, frankly, radiant smiles. She's smiled her way through engagements ever since Prince Philip's death, which was 11 weeks ago after 30 days of mourning. Her Majesty could just be putting on a brave face, but the Daily Mail's editor-at-large, Richard Kay, writes in today's Daily Mail the real reason behind it is an agreement with her husband. And he joins me now. Richard, extraordinary photographs they've used in the spread you've written today. And the headline is great. The poignant promise to Philip behind those radiant smiles. What was that promise?
Well, I think the promise was twofold. I mean, first of all, you've got to remember she has got this amazing iron constitution. And the other part of the Queen's character, of course, is her resilience in the face of adversity. And goodness knows, she's had an awful lot thrown at her over the years, things, family matters she's had to deal with. But the crucial thing, I suppose, is really her relationship with Philip. They were married for 73 years. They were together for so long. And they had that bonus, really, at the end of Philip's long life. He had pretty much been living apart from her up in Sandringham. But because of COVID, they were reunited. So they had, what, something like 13 or 14 months together, side by side at Windsor Castle. And I think it meant an awful lot to her. And during that time, they spoke a lot about the future. And of course, they're not sentimental people, either Philip nor Her Majesty. And Philip's advice was clear. Look, you've got to go on and make the most of your life. And in the same way, if you had died first, I would be doing the same. And I think it is a remarkable grown-up, a mature attitude to old age. And I think we're reaping the benefit of it. The Queen, of course, misses Philip dreadfully. Every day this year, she's having to do things for the first time on her own, where normally she would have had Philip. But she's getting on with it, and she's doing it with grace and a smile.
And she probably knew, didn't she, for a long time that Philip was very ill and that the end was drawing closer?
Yes, I mean, as anyone who has nursed or been with someone who they've cherished and loved and has watched their sad physical decline knows, it's a painful and ultimately very upsetting process. But they are both, or they were both, and the Queen still is, sustained by a strong religious faith. Mm. And that, you know, that helped them enormously get through those last few months of Philip's life.
She, of course, as you say about her strong faith, she will believe firmly that when it's her turn to go, that she'll be reunited with him.
Absolutely. She believes she will be reunited with Philip, as indeed she believes she will be reunited with her beloved father and mother too. And it's marvellous to think that people like the Queen can have a faith like that, which so sustains them.
It's also because I guess some of us who we perhaps didn't think about it deeply enough. We always think about when Queen Victoria's husband died, it was very long, early into their marriage. She virtually disappeared from public view for years. And some of us thought, without Prince Philip, her rock or her stay, as she once called him, that she might go into some form of decline. But the reverse is true.
Well, so it seems, Andrew. I mean, we all wondered quite how the Queen would cope with death and this great loss. And thus far, she's coping extremely well. It was always unlikely that she would have adopted Queen Victoria's approach. I mean, Queen Victoria went into almost perpetual mourning for years on the Isle of Wight. And that isn't the case with the Queen. And the Queen, of course, is that much older. And the Queen has had time to get adjusted to it. Throughout their lives, they had discussed this kind of thing. Philip being 5 years older, there was always the very real chance that he would go first. And I think it reflects a very mature outlook that both of them have had.
And we think, don't we, that she sees quite a lot of Edward and Sophie Wessex, Prince Edward and Sophie Wessex, and he may be in public disgrace, Prince Andrew, but it's always been reported, and you know more about this than anyone, Richard, that Andrew is probably her favourite son. He's in Windsor Great Royal Park. He's a near neighbour too.
Yeah, but the Queen is now living basically full-time at Windsor Castle, and her two closest children are Edward and Andrew. They both live in the environs of Windsor, and they're in and out of the castle all the time to check up on their mother. And she has a very good bond with Edward's wife, Sophie. Mm. And I think those two sons, her younger sons, came at a time of her life when she had planned for childhood, whereas her first two children, Prince Charles and Princess Anne, came just immediately, almost immediately after her marriage, when she was expected to produce heirs and a spare to secure the throne. And I think that it reflects her attitude, her attitudes to Andrew and Edward were slightly different. She had much more time for motherhood and bringing them up.
And just finally, Richard, looking at those photographs, looking at those smiles, she's good to go on for quite a few more years, isn't she? What is she, 95 now?
Well, I don't want to tempt fate, no. Andrew, but I would say she's got a good few years left yeah. in her. I mean, she's in remarkable form. Everyone I spoke to who work in and around the royal household use that phrase all the time, the Queen's in good form. And that means she's got a smile on her face. I mean, she's not running up and down stairs, but she's active still. She still goes out and about, taking a great interest in the running of the Windsor Castle and, of course, in all her public duties too.
Yeah, and of course, as you say, she's carrying out public engagements, the Royal Windsor Horse Show. She was always going to smile at that, of course, because she loves horses.
She loves horses, and of course it allowed her to see her granddaughter, Lady Louise, Edward's daughter, riding in Prince Philip's old trap.
Weren't those photographs lovely?
Beautiful, and absolutely beautiful.
And she would have thought, Prince Philip's looking down, how proud he would have been.
I think so too, Andrew, and I think we must also remember that she had to endure lockdown just like the rest of us, and she has now managed to break out and is seeing people again going up and down the country.
If you haven't read it, do look at Richard Kay's spread in the mail today. Fantastic photographs too, and as ever, beautifully written, Richard, and so well informed. That is our editor-at-large, Richard Kay. Now it's time for our regular city update with Hugo Duncan, Deputy Business Editor at the Daily Mail. Well, Hugo, here we go. A week later, even more good news for the British car industry, which you and I were told during the horror days of Project Fear and the referendum, was going to be eviscerated, emasculated and destroyed.
That's right, Andrew. Last week, you'll recall, we spoke about thousands of jobs secured at Nissan through a big new electric car plant and battery gigafactory being built there. Well, today we have similar news from Vauxhall and its Ellesmere Port plant, which has been the future, I suppose, has been hanging in the balance for some time. There were plenty of warnings around Brexit and what impact it might have. Perhaps more significantly since then has been the this push towards electric vehicles. The Ellesmere Port plant at Vauxhall has made the Astra for years, diesel and petrol Astras, and the future of such cars has very much been thrown into doubt in such plants by this push to electric. Today, the owners of Vauxhall, this new company called Stellantis, has announced that it will be building electric vans, electric vehicles, at the Ellesmere Port plant to secure its future. And this is
that's terrific news, isn't it?
1,000 jobs at the plant, thousands more in the supply chain. It's a big investment, £100 million or so pounds, with some money being pumped in by the government. And this is, as said, this is two in a week.
That's great. So you've got Ellesmere Port, Sunderland with the big Nissan development. And so that's a pretty rosy future for car production in this country.
Well, it is indeed. Both of them have been terrific car plants, terrific employers for many, many years. First, there was Brexit, then there was COVID, and underlying all of this, this big push towards electric, what was going to happen? These companies are letting the money do the talking. They are piling hundreds of millions of pounds into the industry, securing jobs and hopefully making the car industry in Britain look brighter. There is still a long way to go. There are plants all over the country that do not produce electric vehicles. This is going to be what we are going to need to do. We are going to need more batteries. Of course, we'll need charging points, so that these vehicles can actually operate and people want to drive them. But certainly, the owners of Vauxhall and Nissan, they believe that this is the future and are putting the money behind it.
Always good news. Always good to have good news when we're talking city. That's Hugo Duncan, who is, of course, Deputy Business Editor at the Daily Mail. Believe it or not, you can actually get sunburnt eyeballs, according to new research. This information comes out of the Australian Skin Cancer Foundation, which found that eyes are 10 times more sensitive to the sun's invisible ultraviolet rays than skin. So what happens when you get a bad case of eyeball sunburn? Here to explain it all is the health writer, Adrian Monty. Adrian, I have to say, it's a new one on me. I'd never heard of this.
Well, same here, actually, Andrew. I did a lot of health writing, and it did have an impact on me, even to the point where I actually went to my optician's at the weekend and ordered a pair of sunglasses because I thought mine were probably not really adequate enough. So, yes, it surprised me as well, to be honest. So, I guess not many people are aware of it, which I guess is quite worrying, really.
And it's not just sunburn. Of course, you can get skin cancers on the thin skin of the eyelid as well.
That's right. It's because it's just very delicate skin there. I think it's sort of ten times, you know, as we said, more sensitive than the other parts of the body. So it's very susceptible to sunburn. So it really does need protecting with, you know, good quality sunglasses. Really, is the bottom line, I guess. Yeah.
And how do you know? Is it an obvious question that you've got sunburnt eyes? Is it because they feel sore, or is there another feeling?
I think it's the soreness, and I think that you can't feel it while it's happening, is my understanding. But it's sort of
right.
You know, a few hours later, you think, "Ow, my eyes hurt," and a sore sort of redness, and you also may get headaches, and sort of seeing halos in front of your eyes. So all these kind of things like that, and I think it's the feeling in your eyes as well. It's very sort of gritty, like, you know, you get a bit of sand in your eye or something like that. So it's really painful. And luckily, it lasts, you know, a couple of days in most cases. But obviously, if you keep on doing that, it's going to cause more damage. And I think the worry I found talking to the experts I spoke to is that the concern is that if it happens several times, it can just sort of cumulative damage, really. And it may even sort of, you know, be a factor in causing things like cataracts or age-related macular degeneration. So quite serious eye conditions, really, as well as, you know, painful while you're suffering it.
And the thing is, we've all had it drummed into us again and again. We've got to wear high-factor sun cream if we're out in the sun, even if the sun isn't particularly shining. So, for instance, I wear factor 50 nearly all the time.
Right.
It now seems that we're going to have to take wearing a proper, decent pair of sunglasses as seriously.
I think so. I think that was very much the message I got from speaking to opticians and other experts. That I live down here in Brighton, and today it's been raining all morning, and it's cloudy now. And in normal days, I wouldn't really even consider wearing some sunglasses. But I think that is very much the case. That, you know, certainly between sort of summer period, you know, between sort of spring to about September time, just wear them as much as you can. I think the message I got was very much just, you know, if you think about wearing them, you know, wear them type thing rather than something, or I'd rather not really. So, yes, wear them as much as you can.
And here's another health warning here. According to your excellent piece, people with lighter coloured eyes, blue, green or hazed, or have less pigment to protect them against UV rays, so they're more at risk of getting
sunburned
than brown eyes.
Yes, so, well, I'm brown eyes, I'm okay. But yes, a lot of people have to have lighter colours. And it's that pigment which sort of protects your eyes. So, yeah, it's a bit of a genetic reason, isn't it? You're more susceptible because of the colour of your eyes, which is again, quite surprising, really. So even more protection, really, if you've got lighter eyes. You need to wear those shades, really, I think.
Yeah, and we've got to be careful. It's not about the price tag or the designer label sunglasses, Adrian. It's whether the label says it proves gives you UV protection.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's all tempting, isn't it? If you see a pair of cheap shades if you're on holiday or in this country or whatever, and you think, well, they'll do the job. But if they're not protection against UV rays, that they're not any good at all. In fact, if you just wear a pair of dark glasses that don't have this protection, it can cause more damage to your eyes because your eyes dilate because it's in a dark situation, lets more light in, and actually do more harm than good, really. So you really do need to check that's got that label. There should be a little sticky label on the lens or the arm that'll tell you this. But again, you know, if you go to an optician's, I'm sure they'll advise you even more so. But it's just, don't be tempted to buy those cheap ones, those sort of fashion-y type ones, maybe fake ones that are not really the real deal, because you really do need to protect your eyes with proper adequate shades, really.
I bought a cheap pair on Saturday. They're going to have to go in the bin, aren't they? They're going to have to go in the bin.
Right, yeah. Maybe for a fancy dress party or something like that. Yeah.
I did like the look of them. And I thought, I mean, at $9.99, I don't suppose they're going to give me any UV protection, are they, Adrian? Not really.
I think that's the case. I mean, it really isn't, you know, they then had to be super expensive as the other
exactly.
side. They certainly... It's that label that's key to it, whether it's going to protect you from UV rays from the sun, which, you know, damage the sort of front of your eyes and the back of your eyes. And as I said, it can cause those sort of long-term conditions like cataracts when you're in your lens goes cloudy and other conditions as well. So you really do need to take care. As I say, it changed my opinion that I really need to upgrade my shades. So
I'm just about to ask you about that. What are your sunnies like? Are they UV protecting?
They are, they are. And also, again, you know, I wear glasses, but I was very aware that you always get glasses that are a little bit bigger than you would normally have, maybe for your sort of everyday glasses, just because you've been protecting that skin around your eyes and you're blocking that more light out, really. And I know when I was talking to the experts, they were saying for children as well, it's really good. You can get your kids to wear those sort of goggly type glasses, which are, you know, that'll be quite a battle to keep them on, I guess. But again, they stop that light coming in from the side. So again, that'd be really good for kids. And also on that point as well, that it was very much the point that it's never too young to start wearing them, really. You know, it's not just a thing that adults wear. You know, kids can wear them as well. Because I think something like 80% of the light you absorb is before you're 18 type thing. If UV exposure, it's before you're 18. So it's those early years as well that are important.
Absolutely. Very, very interesting. That's Adrian Monti revealing how sunburn can even affect your eyeballs. Thanks for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5pm, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.